Thank you. I hope you'll be clapping afterwards still. I'm impressed, such a big crowd for a talk on microkernels at LCA. Didn't expect that. Okay. Well, do microkernels suck? Some people think they do. There was a talk at OLS, last year's OLS, by Christoph Lameter, whose title was Extreme High Performance Computing or Why Microkernels Suck. And this is the motivation for my talk here. Of course, saying something like that at OLS is about as brave as telling George Bush that the Iraq War was the greatest thing since bottled beer. I'm trying a less easy route. So, what that talk was about, and the slides are of course on the web, etc., is that it explains how they got Linux to scale to about 1,000 CPUs. Great stuff. And reading it, you clearly see he knows what he's talking about, etc. And therefore, I don't need to add any to that. The other thing that's in this paper is why microkernels can't do the same. And in my humble assessment, he hasn't got the faintest. And I'll explain to you why. So basically what he's saying is, hey, well, we scaled Linux to 3,000 CPUs. I mean, big folks have thrown big bucks in that one. And because the microkernel folks haven't done the same, well, they're sort of university groups, right? Obviously they suck. I mean, it's not exactly right. I'm exaggerating, right? Saying, taking some poetic liberty. But just to put that in comparison, this would be the corresponding statement about Linux 10 years ago. Microkernels runs on every, Windows runs on everything, supports all devices, Linux doesn't, so Linux sucks, right? It's probably not a very scientific approach. Well, I could comment about the trouble I've got with this box, particularly the sort of squashed image here, and I'm not sure whether that's Dell's drivers or whoever is responsible for that, but I'm not going down that road. Okay, so let's have a look at some of the statements made in that paper. The one is that, well, the microkernel approach means you have this microkernel, you've got all these individual servers and stuff, which is claimed to be more reliable than the monolithic kernel like Linux. But of course, in fact, it's the opposite, and I've heard the same statement from our hero Linus as well. The failure of one component makes the whole thing fail in reality. Is that true?
Depends on what you're using.
It always depends, true. But sort of as a statement of principle, it's actually clearly wrong. In fact, there's a company called QNX based in Canada who's shipping a thing called their QNX microkernel, or no, it's called the Neutrino microkernel. And they've been doing that for 20 years or something. And since 2001, so that's only 7 years, they commercially sell a thing called the High Availability Toolkit, which is essentially that, right? You have your servers encapsulated, and you have mechanisms to restart them, when to detect when they fall over and restart them, etc. And they obtain really, really high reliability. QNX is one of the systems that's used in life-critical situations, like cars and stuff. And of course, more recently, we had Andy Tannenbaum, Minix 3, and he was here at LCA last year and gave a talk. And of course, you can all check that out for yourself. They have similar technology in there that they detect when things fall over and restart it, etc., without compromising the rest of the system. So, as a matter of fact, microkernels have a pretty good track record in reliability, and they tend to, if you look at the systems that get deployed in really life-critical situations, there's about 5 of them or so, and 3 of them are microkernel systems. Green Hills Integrity, QNX, and Wind River is not a microkernel arm. That's one of the exceptions. I didn't claim all of them are microkernels, right? I'm careful with what I'm saying most of the time. Okay. So, and just as a little side note, this is a contained in an email I got from Saka, who is the leader of the NTFS 3G project, which is an open source implementation of the NTFS file system. And he said, well, sorry, I can't come to LCA this year. I'd like to get your slides afterwards. And basically, he was saying, this is the right approach. And this is quotes from his email. So NTFS3G is a user hybrid space driver, meaning it's mostly run at user level. It has similar functionality and performance on commodity hardware as incremental file systems. So that's a really good point. The invested effort and resource were only a fraction of what is usually needed besides other benefits. So he claims there's very, very solid cost factors supporting this approach. Okay, he thinks this approach shouldn't be discounted simply. But this is only just one voice. I'm just sort of putting it up because it was just sort of timely. Okay. Now, another really common misconception that's sort of propagated in Lameda's paper is because microkernels rely on IPC, which is true, message passing mechanisms. IPC requires expensive message operations, hence IPC is costly. That's outright bullshit. I mean, that's true was for systems like MAR, but if anyone sort of is even sort of less than 20 years out of sync with the operating systems literature, then they know about L4, which in 1993 in SOSP, that's the main operating systems conference, that's where all the new research gets published, published this paper showing how to make IPC really fast. And there's no bloody message queues. It's, if you know what you're doing, you don't do that. Whoops. And so just sort of a bit of shameless advertising. One of the effects of that is that L4 is actually in real use in real systems. And in particular, unlike QNX, by the way, it's in use in where performance really matters. Mobile devices. If you have a mobile phone, you can't afford a 50% systems overhead because it's battery powered. Every cycle you waste is some picojoule or whatever you waste. It shortens your battery lifetime. So in mobile phones, performance really matters. And there are zillions out there. I estimate roughly at the moment, probably about 50 million or so. It's growing by the day. Within a year, we should reach a quarter billion mobile phone handsets out there in customers' pockets running on L4. So it is not something that's to be ignored. And the reason why this is suddenly happening is because A, it's small, and in embedded systems, particularly battery-powered ones, memory footprint can't because memory consumes energy, and it's fast, so you don't get unreasonable overhead. And this is a real motivator. It supports fault containment, exactly that thing.
Is it GPL?
There's different versions of L4. They're under different open source licenses. Every L4 version I know of is under an open source license. Ours is under a Sleepy Cat style license. So it's GPL-ish a bit.
It's a phone that runs L4.
Yes.
Can you repeat the question, please?
Oh, yeah. Okay. What commercial phones run L4? I have to say, at the moment, they're all Windows phones, and it's going to break my heart when I go out next week to buy one, so I finally have got a phone that runs my operating system. But at the moment, they're all high-end smartphones running Windows on the application processor and L4 on the baseband processor. I know, I've got people...
phones on the Asian market that use L4 in the Linux server running the smartphone part.
Can anyone call them manufacturer? There are some phones that have
There's HTC phones. The HTC Titan, you can get it here in Australia since about 3 months or so. And other HTC phones. I don't know all of them that are out there. That's part of the open source business, right?
But
yeah, that's a careful estimate. I mean, basically, Qualcomm is shipping all their new generation wireless chipsets with L4, running the baseband stack on L4. And Qualcomm sells a quarter billion chips a year. And they've been out in the market for over a year now, so it's a very conservative estimate. I'm not aware of any Linux ones out yet. They will be out soon, but I'd be surprised if there are any out. I haven't heard about that. Okay, but this is sort of a really distraction. So let's look at the IPC issue, because that's really a critical point if you want to understand microkernels and what they can and can't do. It is true, IPC is a critical operation, and the main thing that distinguishes microkernels from monolithic kernels is that you obtain services by IPC. So in a system like Linux, in order to obtain a system service, you execute a syscall trap. It gets you into the kernel, typically somewhere down there in the exception handler, and then the thing gets sort of handed back up to the appropriate level where it's starting to be dealt with, and typically call goes up and down a few times, and in the end you come out again. So the cost of getting to start executing the code that actually delivers your service is two mode switches. You switch from user mode into kernel mode, and in the end you switch back from kernel mode into user mode, right? The critical difference in a microkernel-based system is your microkernel itself is essentially just a message passing engine. That's all it, that's pretty much almost all it does, is deliver messages between different components. So in order to, you get this, well, in a half in a traditional monolithic system, you've got this vertical layering. Here you've got this horizontal structure where everything runs besides each other. So the basic operation in order to, for obtaining some service, is to send a message to the appropriate server. And that costs you two message passing operations. So a message passing operation means trap into the kernel, do a context switch, come out of the kernel, so two mode switches and one context switch, and then you have to get the same thing back. So you have a total of four mode switches and two context switches. So compared to this scenario, oops, your cost is increased by two mode switches and two context switches. That's the inherent cost you get in any operation in the microkernel. The question is whether this is relevant or not. So this is something you can't debate away. There's everything you can do in a microkernel, you can always do faster in a monolithic kernel by two mode and two context switches. Leaving away things like cache footprints, which may favor the microkernel if you do it right, but I'm not really getting into that. Okay, so question is, is this cost significant? Well, how big is it? What's kernel entry and kernel exit cost on a modern processor? P4 is of course the most horrendous example, and thankfully Intel has moved away from that one. On the other Intel processor, the Itanium, guess how much it is on the Itanium if you do it right. Any other? Huh? Any other ones? One cycle. Itanium is a really cool architecture. They really knew what they were doing. So there's a big discrepancy, right, between 1 and 1,000. Typically, RISC processors, which are typically used in embedded systems, as well as sort of less brain damaged microarchitectures of Intel, you're looking at a few hundred cycles. How about the context switch?
Depends on how many registers you have to save, how much context you have to save, and then that depends on the operating system.
Well, the inherent cost doesn't depend on the operating system, right? But the inherent cost depends on the architecture. So the hardware dictated cost is, yes, the cost of saving and restoring the register state, which in a RISC process is typically 16 or 32 registers, so multiply that by 2, and that's the worst case for single-issue processor. You can get it faster if you're lucky.
Plus TLB impact.
That's really the killer normally, right? And on any decent architecture, that means anything other than IA32, this is a one cycle, just to reload the TLB context register. Whereas on x86, you trash the whole TLB, and the direct cost is low, but the indirect cost is you get a TLB miss on every page you touch. And this is sort of what that's up. So, now come back. This is real data for L4. And you can say it doesn't look that bad, right? It's sort of in line with what I said. the characteristic of L4 is it adds to the minimum hardware dictated overhead only about 10 or 20%, not more. So it's essentially as fast as it can be. So, and you can see I left off the Pentium 4 because thankfully it's a dead architecture. This is Pentium 3 data. The core, we haven't really measured that on the core yet. The core should be similar to a Pentium 3, probably a bit higher than that. MD64, they actually did a few smart things, but they went off that again. Itanium, I tell you, I like this architecture. Does a complete context switch in 36 cycles. And this is sort of typical embedded processes, RISC architectures, 1 to 200 cycles. So this is the basic cost you're copying, yeah?
The headings on the table are confusing. Which one? Type on the right.
Intra address space, meaning IPC operation between two threads in the same address space versus inter address space is two threads in different address
space. The right hand side is the inter.
Oh, it says intra both times, yes. Sorry, yes. The right one is inter. Okay. So, the question is, this 200 cycles, how does that compare to the system, to an actual system call, to the work you actually deliver? Of course, if it's bigger or about the same size, then it's a huge overhead. If it's just less than a percent, it doesn't matter. Now, what's the typical number of cycles for a system call in Linux? It particularly depends a lot on the actual system call, right? So on the null system call, that's going to be a real killer. So if your system does null system calls all day, then your performance overhead is going to be mind-boggling. if it does things like file system operations, etc., it's going to be negligible. Yeah. Sure, if you can do it without getting in the kernel in Linux, you can do that without getting in the kernel in a microkernel too. So, okay, so this is the story about IPC. Now let's see what the impact on the real system would really be. So the test bed we're using here is sort of, it's not really a worst case, but it's really a bad scenario in the sense that we're comparing native Linux to Linux virtualized on top of L4. So that means we get, because it's running on top of L4, we get the full microkernel overhead. So whenever the application calls into Linux, that happens via an IPC operation through the L4 kernel into here, right? Compared to just trapping into it. So it got the full overhead with no zero benefit because it doesn't do any more than just running on native Linux. So what's the performance of that like? This is ReAIM. It's a system benchmark. So this measures what you really see in a system in a multitasking load. So native, these are seconds, I think. No, these are not seconds because big is better on this one. Yeah, it's just a number. So big is better. Native is better than virtualized, not surprising, but the difference is 3 or 4%. So most people would say 3 or 4%, who cares, right? Yeah. Even
unless it's TPC.
Hey?
Unless it's TPC. In that case, it's a couple of million dollars.
not in this sort of load. basically, I mean, I'll show you that these numbers are actually can even be improved on, but it's something for normal, in most cases, overall performance difference of 3%, no one will care about. And this is now sort of looking a bit closer from micro benchmark to micro benchmark where you can actually see what's happening, LM bench, right? And one of the things you see is, okay, we've got work to do with fork in exec. They have only about 2/3 of the performance, but we know about that and we know how to fix it. We just haven't got around it. And everything else is sort of essentially on par. So if you do a really very high rate of process creation and destruction, then you would see an impact, otherwise not according to this figure. I'm getting to that. Pipe sticks out as being faster. Yes, well observed. And as a matter of fact, there's a whole bunch of them that stick out as being faster. Everything to do with context switching. Up to a factor 50 faster. How can that be? The virtualized system faster than the native system. This is on an X scale, which is an ARM V5 processor, and they're known to have a quirky MMU. So essentially what you see here is that it's much easier to optimize the hell out of a code base of 10,000 lines than a million lines of code. It's just higher optimized. Essentially what happens is the ARM MMU is pretty temperamental, and in order to ensure that you don't get any data corruption, people generally on the context switch flush a TLB in the cache. Very expensive operation. And that's what Linux does on, as standard Linux does on the ARM. Turns out you can actually avoid it by really making very cool use of the of the hardware features, but it requires a bit of work.
So you're using fast context switch extensions on the outboard?
Yes.
But not on Linux?
Well, we use the standard Linux kernel. Right? Yeah. This tells you one thing about microkernels. It's not, I'm not trying to sell you snake oil here. Basically, this means it's easier to optimize a small code base. It doesn't mean you can't do the same thing in Linux. As a matter of fact, we've done it. And we offer the patches upstream. They didn't want it. What's a factor of 50 between friends? some people, for example, Snapgear, they sell modems that are running a kernel without patches, but it's actually being used.
Part of the problem with that is it's made by adder space limit when you're using fast context switch extensions. It's useful as a highly optimized tuning for things where you don't need broadband space.
Yep. The fact, of course, is that most ARM processors run in embedded systems that don't have this huge amount of memory anyway, so it's really appropriate.
Are any of these multiprocessor ARMs?
No. I'm getting to the multiprocessing issue. Okay, back to multiprocessing. What he says is, essentially, this is paraphrased, right? This is not explicitly written up like this. RPC is needed across nodes inside a microkernel OS. On a NUMA, this causes problems allocating the message queues in a NUMA-friendly fashion. Now, I already argued that the message queues don't exist if you know what you're doing, because you don't want the kernel to buffer messages, essentially. That's a nice performance hit. So, okay, what's behind that? Somehow, there's the assumption that on a NUMA system, when you obtain system services, there's communication going on between nodes, and you need to be careful and optimize that. So that's an interesting concept. So assume this is your NUMA system. There's a zillion nodes here. Each of them is running some portion of the OS and some application code, right? So if this application is doing a system call, where would you want the OS to run for servicing that system call? On this node or on that node? I mean, what?
Does the crate use the close, but not the same node as the unicorn?
Say again?
Yeah, and the crate unicorns and P, which is like the big supercomputer microkernel nesting.
Yeah, I used it in my former life, yeah.
It's just using a close, but not the same node, but the OS node is close to the application.
Yeah. But if you think about it, in most cases, when an application does a system call, it wants something from the system. And in most cases, there's asynchronous system calls, but in most cases, it can't do anything more sensible until that system call is serviced, right? So the best thing you can do for the application is deliver the service as quickly as possible running on that same node, because the application is stalled anyway.
Does that change with what Jonathan was talking about in the kernel report?
Unfortunately, I wasn't there. I was just flying in. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reasons for using asynchronicity in many cases. And if that's the case, then, well, the story might look different. Right? But as a general rule, there's no reason to have any communication just to obtain a service from the system across nodes, because it's a silly thing to do. Now,
but that's a Luma system, right? I mean, if you just more of a classic shared memory pool.
It's the same thing. If you have a multi-core processor, same thing. You want the OS to run on you. I mean, the more data, shipping data around always costs you, right?
In a local cache.
Yeah. Shipping data always costs. At the very least, you have to ship your parameter buffers to the kernel that's handling the stuff. And that costs. Transferring every cache line costs. Okay. So you want to do that on the local core. Now, this is actually some real data that's been published a few years ago. I'm not saying yet when. And it looks at multiprocessor scalability. Only up to 16 processors, so you can sort of roughly gauge when this would have been done. And also, if you look at what the systems that are compared to, fortunately, you can't really read that, I think. So there's a bunch of commercial systems and some other system. What it measures is slowdown, meaning the extra cost over the uniprocessor case for doing certain operations as a function of the number of processors. So obviously for one processor, the slowdown is zero, is nothing, yeah, zero, and then goes up to 16. And by the way, the slowdown is a logarithmic scale, so this is 1 and this is 10. So the slowdowns here are pretty massive. Now, the data is a few years old. So what's what you want to see? What you want to see is obviously it goes up from 1 to 2 somewhat, because that's inevitable. And then you want to see something that's flat, like this curve here, right?
But IBM, does that mean AIX? Or does that mean PowerPC?
I don't know. I'd have to look it up. It doesn't matter that much.
Is Sun Spark or is Sun Solaris?
Sun would presumably be Solaris on Spark. Sorry, it's not that relevant, right? SGI is presumably IRIX on MIPS process. So what you can see, hello, what you can see is all the systems have horrible overhead except this one. And what it does here is this is page faults, so the cost of handling page faults. And this is doing fstats, and this is doing thread creates. Now, the thing is, what it's doing is, it's doing the same operation every node. So basically, the OS here, and this is where the scalability problems actually happen. The OS here in the 16 processor code case has to handle, to deal with 16 threads on the, each on a different node, doing page faults at the same time, or doing fstats, or doing thread creates. And you can see this is where those systems scaled horribly. The upper graphs are different threads all belonging to the same process, and the lower graph are each thread being a different process, the different address space. And you can actually see the systems in generally scale better in this case. So, okay, now the question is, what sort of system is that, and when was that data taken? The system is called Tornado. It's a predecessor of K42, which is was done at IBM Labs. And it was published in 1999, 9 years ago, at the OSDI conference, which is the other big OS conference. It was done by a small group at Uni Toronto. So they achieved pretty damn good scalability back 8, 9 years ago. So how far did Linux scale in those days? And to ask the follow-on question, if you do the same sort of load, how far would Linux scale these days? Because when we hear that Linux scales to 1,000 nodes, what it really means is you can run an HPC application that does essentially zero system calls running on 1,000 nodes. But as soon as the load starting and Grand Brundler is nodding violently in the back, as soon as you start actually using system calls, your scalability starts to deteriorate very badly. Now, those guys had figured it out almost 10 years ago. Yes. Yeah, get time of day will scale nicely, I reckon. Okay.
There's been quite a bit of work done on the scalability of Linux since then.
I know.
And just in terms of decoupling critical sections within the kernel, preempt RT.
Yeah. All I'm saying is, if you run the same benchmarks, I bet you $100 it's not going to scale like this today.
But it won't scale like the other ones
either. No, it will be much better, yeah, sure. So basically, this is all in the context. Microkernels don't scale as well as Linux, so the microkernels suck, right? I don't think, if you actually look at the facts, that's a well-supported statement. Okay, now to synchronization. One of the things he makes a big story of is that, okay, you have to, that in order to make Linux scalable, they put a lot of effort into synchronization. That's not surprising. In the end, this is sort of the critical thing for multiprocessor scalability is synchronization. And he gives a very nice overview of the various mechanisms they use for various different purposes. All very good stuff. And then he makes the statement that data structures, microkernel isolation limits synchronization methods, data structures have to be particular to subsystems. Linux would have never been able to scale to these extremes with the microkernel approach because of the rigid constraints that strict microkernel design place of the architecture of operating systems. That's just complete baloney. The thing is, if your system is well designed, what you need to synchronize is inside the subsystems. And you don't normally synchronize between different subsystems. Otherwise, something is wrong in your system design. And by the way, there's no reason why you can't do similar things in microkernel. Microkernel systems, they allow you to share memory just like anything else. So those system servers, if they have to, they can share memory. And they can have locks and shared memory and all this sort of stuff. Right? So basically, this is just folklore that's not supported by the facts. What really do you need to do in order to get an OS scalable? The real thing is, remember, an operating system is essentially overhead. It just stops user processes from doing what they want to do. So the OS, the primary job of the OS is really get out of the way. And but if you talk to database people, they will tell you they rant on and on about exactly that. And as far as scalability is concerned, is the operating system must not inhibit the scalability of your running code. In other words, if you write your application code to be scalable, in other words, which really means to avoid synchronization events, then the operating system should not destroy the scalability. Now, how do you achieve that? In the end, there's only one way to do that, by keeping things as local as possible, right? So a properly designed OS, OS that's designed for scalability, needs to keep data structures local as much as possible. And some of the work Lametta describes is actually doing that, right? They're working on localizing data structures in Linux as much as possible. But I really got a far way to go for making this really consistently. So, and sort of it comes back, if you really want to push microkernels, then, well, you have a much smaller code base to optimize.
So why does Disney know it gets smaller when you put it in your code?
Say again?
So your code's not getting smaller by putting in your services.
Okay, let me defer this question for one moment.
We've got 5 more minutes.
Yeah. I'm on my second last slide, and then I'm happy to take any questions. So basically, I think it's pretty bad practice to say, I can do this thing, and you can't, without understanding what the capabilities of you are, right? And the world would be a much better place if people concentrated on talking what they know about rather than what they don't. There's no doubt that Linux is cool. I'm the first one to admit this. But that doesn't mean it's the best thing for everything. And exactly the same applies to microkernels, too. Microkernels are cool. That doesn't mean they're the best thing for everything. That's pretty much the end of my talk. So I'm happy to entertain any questions here. So the question from the back, which I deferred, was your code isn't getting smaller by splitting it up into subsystems. True, absolutely. The overall size of a microkernel-based, of a well-designed microkernel-based system in lines of, in total lines of code, is going to be bigger than the monolithic system. Absolutely no argument. But on the other side, what's going to be much easier is to remove, to leave out the components you don't need. But that's not. Yeah. No, it's not. And in particular, if you look at what's really performance critical, with modern architecture, the performance of an operating system is primarily determined by what? By its cache footprint. And the more you lump the critical things that are needed at any time together into as small data structure as possible, the better performance you can achieve. Now, this doesn't mean, I've never argued that microkernel will give you better performance than monolithic system. Inherently, they don't. To the contrary, I claimed you always got this small overhead. But as a matter of fact, in many cases, you might find it's actually much easier to optimize.
I mean, hopefully your application will mostly run in user space.
It depends what you're doing.
Right, that's what I mean.
If you run Oracle, it's not.
And the operating system may or may not be accurate.
Yeah, but that doesn't stop your operating system from limiting the scalability necessarily, right?
So you're rebutting Christoph's assertion. I'm wondering if you had a chance to communicate with them as you want to think about your
Whether I had a chance to communicate my rebuttal to him. Well, when I saw the paper, I actually sent a mail and said, I'm sort of a bit sad that you mingle up your great achievements in, or you devalue your great achievements in getting Linux scalability achieved by making unqualified statements about microkernels. But on top of that, I had actually heard that talk before. And that was at a workshop Intel ran up in Portland in November 06, so about 15 months ago. And it was specifically about multi-core. So it was a multi-core optimization, the compiler people, OS people there, Linus was there as well. And he gave that talk there. And interestingly, he gave it right after Volkmar Ulig, who's done a PhD on scalability in microkernels. did his spiel in showing how you can actually achieve microkernel and how you can actually utilize the structure to make scalability easier. And Christoph afterwards, totally ignored what's been said before him. So he's been given all the information and he chose to just close his ear or whatever, I don't know.
Everybody always attacks microkernels for being slow and nobody ever questions their reliability. Because everybody knows they are more reliable.
That's not the claim that's been made. No.
Well, in my experience, I work with a few message passing systems, actually quite old, and they were Amiga OS, OS2, and even the Heart. And all three of them have this tendency of deadlocking very easily, because one of those processes would die or like not respond, and all the others would just die. As a domino effect.
Sure. The statement made was that his experience with old microkernel systems in the past is that they had a tendency to deadlock. And if you have a multi-server system which communicates, it's very easy to produce deadlocks, and you have to really sort of know what you're doing in the system design. There's no doubt about that. But you can produce deadlocks in Linux as well if you try to, right?
If
you care less.
Extremely hard to debug, I remember.
Deadlocks.
Die in pieces.
Yeah, deadlocks are always horrible to debug.
My experience with Hurt was it took me 30 seconds after touching Hurt for the first time if the system dead. And my experience with Linux is at least I can still get a backtrace, and I have just two deadlock processes, but I can still see what those two processes were doing.
And
the fact is that it's asynchronous that locks what you get in microkernel systems, because it's not synchronous, which is way easier to debug, actually.
It depends. But I mean, in the end, it's a design choice, right? Do you want the protection that is given you by encapsulating things in address spaces, or don't you? And from what I can tell in the embedded systems industry, industry is moving that way of actually utilizing that. And system design has never been easy. It's never going to be easy. There's no simple recipes. You can't just build a system of really lots of functionality without knowing exactly what you're doing. Any operating system that really works has a lot of thought and, in most cases, experimentation, and in some cases also theory put in. It's not trivial, right? And you can stuff up an OS of any sort of kind. And the herd is obviously a pretty bad example of an OS.
One thing that's often overlooked is that not only do you get reliability, but security gaps as well. I can create a file system that will make it a Linux kernel in reference invalid pointers when it's mounted. And this could theoretically be used on a removable device to compromise the machine.
Sure. I mean, the statement was that it's security benefits, and that's definitely true, right? I mean, in my eyes, it's insane how much code runs privileged in a Linux system, or Windows for that matter. I mean, Windows is worse, obviously, because it's just more bloated. Linux is these days about as bloated as Windows was 5 years ago, and it's heading the same direction. I mean, the fact that there is tens of thousands of lines of device driver code in the kernel is insane if you think about it. There's no reason for doing that. There's in a system, there's maybe three performance critical device drivers where it may be necessary to run them in kernel mode for performance reasons. The rest is irrelevant performance wise, and they should be out in user land. And as a matter of fact, we've shown that with gigabit Ethernet drivers, which is obviously one of the most performance critical drivers because they give you very high interrupt rates, you can run them at user level with a 10% performance impact. So very few drivers really need to be in the kernel, even in a high performance system.
But whether it's in the kernel or not doesn't really matter. What matters is, does my system still run if it crashes?
No, well, it does matter, because if your driver overrides a random memory location in Linux, you're dead.
Right.
And there's no way to recover from it.
I mean, it's
already
yes,
kernel, I'm not.
But if your USB stack overrides a random memory location, that shouldn't crash your system. Obviously, there are some drivers that are inherently part of a trusted computing base, right? You can't load a new driver if you don't have access to the disk.
Right.
And similar things.
But
why are your audio drivers in kernel mode? Why is the USB stack in kernel mode? I mean, why is all this crap in there? Where's the mouse driver in kernel mode?
I have the opposite problem. I have XOR needs some user space, and that makes XOR really prone to hard lock, to crash the system, because being the user space process, when it crashes, there is no way to restore the original, like, video mode and so on.
No, it doesn't.
XOR usually found
as
a
voice
crashes,
so
I can SSH
it
to my machine.
And
if it was
to be as
a kernel,
the machine would be. You aren't using any required features, but sometimes it crashes the way you don't.
Yeah, I'm tired of X placement.
Okay. That's what I'm here.
My question is, it really necessary to have separate processes to get the benefits of microkernels? I read some research in the early 90s where people were suggesting that compilers and file systems separately can actually get the benefits without.
Yeah. There's essentially two approaches to achieve the same thing. The one is what we do with the classical microkernel approach, where you encapsulate everything in address space and essentially use hardware mechanisms for protection, right? The alternative is to use language mechanisms. And that's what Singularity folks at Microsoft Research are doing. They're writing a system from scratch. They call it a microkernel. It's not a microkernel in my eyes. if it helps give it the term a better name, that's good, fine with me. they're rebuilding an OS from scratch, which is totally based on language type protection, type safety. And it would be, well, in the end, you would think, well, this has got to be faster than using MMU for protection because you don't have the context switching costs, etc. Turns out that language protection costs as well because you have a lot of runtime checks and you need them. And in the end, so far, integrity hasn't beaten us performance-wise. They get close, so it's definitely a reasonable approach. The problem, of course, is what do you do with all this legacy software? Do you rewrite everything in C# or C# or whatever they use? And then the other thing is, if you have a type-safe language like C# or Java or whatever, somehow you need the support to implement that language, right? You have a runtime system, you have a garbage collector and all this sort of stuff. And that stuff is not type-safe. And I talk fairly regularly to Galen Hunt, who is the leader of the Singularity project, and he admits freely that they have more dirty code in their system than all of L4. we're actually working on a formal verification, meaning a mathematical proof that the system implementation corresponds to the specification, or more slang expression would be just to prove that it's bug-free, right? And we're about half a year away of being there. Singularity, they will probably attempt the same sooner or later. I haven't started, but they have a better job because there's just more dirty code than we have.
Okay, we've got time for one more question.
Google has presented.
Can you put your hand up?
Yeah, there's someone back in the back who hasn't asked a question yet. No? Okay, it's back to you then. Second?
DMA engines. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, obviously, on contemporary architecture, DMA can always screw you over, right? So taking the driver in the user level doesn't encapsulate it. It can still override any sort of physical memory. It still gives you a lot of protection. And when we played with that, we found there's actually really true that it's easier to debug because lots of bugs are simply pointed the references that go wrong, etc., and that's caught by the normal protection mechanism. But it doesn't give you security. But of course, finally, the hardware manufacturers have woken up to that, and Intel is coming out with what's called VTD, which is essentially an MMU for I/O space. And that allows you to fully encapsulate DMA bus mastering drivers just as any normal application. And that's really cool stuff.
Okay,